Hello, everyone. My name is Louis Dorsey, and my reason for being here tonight is because of my friendship with Alan Forley. The last time I was with Alan at his own apartment, he and I spoke of this time, and he said to me, "What are you going to do?" And I said to him, "What do you want to do?" He said to me, "Do what you would like in relationships to a memorial for me." As a result of that, I planned this night. So, with that in mind, I'd like to introduce to you the manager of KALW, Mr. Matt Martin.
Thank you, Louis. Everybody has to leave eventually. And what distinguishes the departures that every one of us is going to make is what kind of web of friendship and connection and meaning that we leave behind. In the time between Alan's diagnosis in August and his passing in October and this time now, I've had the really good fortune of getting to know Alan a lot better. Most importantly, through the connections that I learned about that he had made with people, so many people, and some of them like Louis and Fred Lipschultz, who are here tonight, who I just getting to know them better in this process has been very, very beautiful, and it helped me understand Alan better, and also from people at the whole other end of the spectrum, people who never met Alan, but who heard his voice and who felt that when he was no longer on KALW that they had lost a friend. I am a radio person. That's how I knew Alan. And it was a good relationship. We had a lot of fun and made a lot of good radio together. And most of the people in this room, I suppose, know Alan as a radio person. But there are some people who have a totally different perspective on him. And one of them sent us a message this last Friday, and I'm just going to read it. This is from Harold Larson. "Alan Forley was my student at San Juan Capistrano High School in the early 1950s. He was in my math, physics, and chemistry classes. We were very close. He would drop by my home often. Besides having a love for science and math, we also shared a love of classical music. On one occasion, Alan visited the Berkshires in Massachusetts, where he heard the Boston Symphony Orchestra play Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. I can remember Alan saying that the Ninth was Beethoven's greatest symphony. He was dismayed to hear that I preferred Beethoven's Fifth. In retrospect, I think Alan's preference was the correct one. Alan was a brilliant student. On one occasion, our class went on a field trip to Caltech in Pasadena. Richard Feynman entertained the many high school students who were there, and Alan was so impressed by the future Nobel laureate in physics that he was determined on graduation from high school he would apply for registration at Caltech. He loved Caltech and would speak to me often of his pleasure in being in contact with Richard Feynman. Alan got his PhD in mathematics, and he also authored a book on topology. He was a wonderful young man. I so regret we did not stay in touch with each other through all these years. I would have expected that he would have had a career as a university professor in mathematics. It came as a big surprise to learn of his tenure at KALW. From what I read of Alan's four decades at the station, it appears my former student was a great teacher. San Francisco was so fortunate to have had such a wonderful man to listen to all these years." Harold Larson. So I know that there are many, many people in this room who had different kinds of connections to Alan, different ways of appreciating him and what he brought to all of us. And I am going to invite anyone who would like to come and make some brief remarks in a moment to come up and take the microphone. I know people have known him in many different ways. But first I'm going to ask a few people who just I know to have had a special connection with Alan to come up and start things off. Paul Drescher, composer here in the Bay Area, Kathy Williams, the West Coast liaison for the Noel Coward Society, and Roman Mars, a radio producer at KALW and beyond, who worked with Alan. Paul?
Well, it's great to be a part of this remembrance of Alan. I guess I'm one of those people who also knew Alan primarily because of the radio, although I was fortunate enough to be in the control booth with him many times. Alan was a very generous and passionate supporter of contemporary music, which was obviously my endeavor. So I was often in the booth with him talking about programs that were upcoming from my own group, the projects that I was involved in. But over the years of doing that, and that started for me almost 30 years ago when I first started to have a professional life in the Bay Area, Alan would invite me to the studio, and that was on Harrison Street, in a very shabby little environment, I remember, although we didn't move up that far when we moved to the current environment. But then we just started to run into each other at performances of all kinds, whether it was the opera or the ballet or contemporary music performance. And I realized that Alan was just a totally passionate fellow traveler about the performing arts. And he brought that, what he brought to that passion was something that I think as was alluded to in the letter that was just read, is that he taught us a lot about the best things that what the performing arts can do to make us a more humane society, and perhaps the goal of all living is to be able to appreciate and share and create in the arts. So I just want to thank you all for being here, and please share your remembrances of Alan.
To share with you messages from two of Alan's closest friends and colleagues in England, Dominic Vlasto and John Knowles. From Dominic, a Cambridge-trained musicologist and performer. When Alan Farley started his quest more than 30 years ago to unearth background information on the life and music of Noel Coward, it led him naturally enough to England, where among the first people he met was Graham Payne, the successor to the Coward estate. On increasingly frequent visits to the UK during the 1980s, Alan was given access to the Coward estate archives, and he tracked down and recorded interviews with many people who had worked with Coward, as he was also doing in the US. One of these many was Norman Hackford, Coward's longtime accompanist and amanuensis, who'd been the inspiration behind Dominic's first study of Coward's music. Once introduced, Alan and I instantly became close friends through our mutual frustration at finding there was no definitive catalog of Coward's music. While I had musicological expertise in written down arrangements and performance techniques, Alan was the truffle hunter of the recorded musical legacy, often nosing out completely forgotten test pressings or other recordings. And I was lucky enough to have Alan once tell me he related an example of his talent in locating rare Coward treasures. In Coward's secretary Joan Hurst's cupboard, I discovered an unreleased recording of Coward singing Mad About the Boy, which Coward always denied he had ever recorded. And this is back to Dominic. After several years of visits and several hundred faxes and emails, Alan and my Noel Coward Music Index, the NCMI, was sponsored into existence by the Noel Coward Society and eventually became a vital part of online resources which are now maintained by the Coward Estate. And we'll move on to some comments from John Knowles, who is the chairman of the Noel Coward Society. Alan was very generous for the society and often gave a sizable donation rather than just a membership fee. He bought a set of then-unknown radio broadcast recordings on our behalf and gave them to the Society to add to our archives. I met him on several occasions and entertained him at lunch when we were finalizing the adoption of the NCMI on the Coward Estate website. I had, of course, worked with Alan and Dominic to transfer the NCMI into web pages and met Alan each time he came over to the UK. He sent me copies of his NC birthday broadcasts, some of which were featured on the NCS website, and then KALW started to feature them on their own site. Together with Dominic, he was always my first port of call for inquiries on Coward's music. Alan aired the 30th annual birthday special last year on December 16, 2011. When asked about the history of the broadcast, Alan recalled, "While I had always enjoyed Noel Coward's works, it was probably the gift from my friend Ronald Benson of volumes of Coward's plays at Christmas 1981 and on my birthday in 1982 that got me more interested. And when asked to do a program to substitute for a regular musical series, I did the first birthday special on Coward's birthday in 1982. By the time of the Coward centenary in 1999 and the unveiling of Noel Coward's statue in the foyer of the Theatre Royal, Drury Lane, by the Queen Mother, Alan had firmly established himself as a recognized authority on Coward. Alan was one of the very few at that event who were specifically selected by Graham Payne to meet the Queen Mother, who'd been a personal friend of Coward's. And in the slideshow, there's actually a photo. She's wearing a lovely blue outfit, I think, and a large hat. Alan spent his last Christmas time in the UK, where he was firstly the Coward Society's guest of honor at its annual Coward birthday celebrations in the Theatre Royal, and then Dominic's house guest in Norfolk. Dominic writes that he's particularly sad to be unable to be with us tonight, as he has the warmest possible memories of a visit he made as Alan's guest to San Francisco in the fall of 2003, when the huge warmth of the welcome he received from all of Alan's friends and colleagues reflected so well the respect and affection in which Alan himself was held. The world of Noel Coward has lost a true friend and champion, and I'm sure that the strength of the NCS membership on the west coast of the USA is largely due to Alan's ever-present influence on the airwaves in all our lives over the past 3.5 decades. His gentle humanity and supportive friendship will be sorely missed here at home and far beyond the confines of the Bay Area. And now, Roman.
So my name is Roman Mars, and I'm a radio producer, and Alan's impact on my life has been sort of immeasurable. He was the first person I ever produced radio for. He's the first person who put me on the radio. He's the first person to donate money to me to send me to a conference. I've been trying to, you know, since he got sick and since he died, I've been thinking about all of his influence on my life, and I think he's probably of the past 10 years, the most influential person on my life. He made me the broadcaster I am today. And what I remember about him is the first time he had a way about him that he could make you feel, he made you nervous in the beginning. He had a way about him, he could make you nervous. You had to please him. And I remember the first time one of my first jobs at KLW in 2001 was cutting the pledge drive. So you get an hour-long program and you cut them down to 45 minutes so you can do the pitching around it. And so I did that, and I used to make cue sheets to tell when the program breaks happened. And I wasn't making them very good at first, and so he corrected me. And then I made the proper cue sheet, and I formatted it out, and he came up to me and said, "I thought this came right off the DAX, which is from the National Programming Office." And I felt like his approval, I felt like sunshine had hit my face for the first time. I felt so great. And that's how, you know, he made you feel, and what he did for me. And I just adored him. And I think about him as a broadcaster. I loved his voice, and he had the little bit of the rumble and this little bit of a high whisper in the way that he presented. And he had the greatest sign-off. He said, "Thanks for listening." I love that sign-off because he was about listening. He was a great interviewer because he let people talk. And so I just think that that's the greatest thing. So thanks for listening.
So if there is anyone else who would like to come and take the microphone, please come up. And I just ask that folks be brief, because I'm sure there's a few folks who want to say something. And we've got Wesley Whitfield and Mike Greenseal waiting in the wings to perform a couple of tunes for us. So I know folks want to hear that. So,
quick and dirty.
Marilyn Pittman.
Thank you very much. My name is Marilyn Pittman. I'm an actor and a comedian, and I am the host and producer of Out in the Bay. So perhaps some of you who just hear the sound don't know the face, but I have a good face for radio, I know. Thanks a lot. These are the jokes, people. I just broke my glasses a few seconds before coming up here. That's how nervous I was. As an old pro, I'm getting nervous. What is that about? Well, it's a memorial. Someone who... Okay, here's the thing. I had... The first date I ever had with my wife was with Alan Farley. And John Hammond, who's here, a distant relative of Dashiell Hammond. And the four of us had a drink at Twin Peaks, the bar, also called the Glass Coffin, at Market and Castro here in the city, up in the little room upstairs, away from all the disdainful gay men who don't want women in there. Or they didn't at the time, and this was 14 years ago, and she's my wife, partner still. And so that first date was auspicious. It was an auspicious beginning. And it was with Alan Farley, who I had developed a bit of a friendship with after working with off and on and being around off and on for many years, since the 80s when I moved to San Francisco. We were both in radio. And I'm an actor, and he's a theater aficionado. And so I hold him with special regard, and I worked with alongside him. We both had passions. I decided to wear my Giants hat. I never really wear this out in an event like this, but I thought, well, I'll wear the hat, and since I'm getting my hair done tomorrow, it'll really work out. And then I wore my Giants shirt, because one of the things I discovered about Alan in the brief, not brief time I knew him, but in the few conversations we had as colleagues working together, is his passion for the Giants. So I decided to represent my San Francisco Giants and Alan Farley's San Francisco Giants tonight here at the memorial. I'd like to close by saying a few things. I thought that I would let Noel Coward say them for me, actually. And I have a few quotes from Noel Coward, and here they go. "I like long walks, especially when they are taken by people who annoy me." This captures Alan. Noel Coward, I mean, alter ego? Id? I don't know. "I love criticism just so long as it's unqualified praise. I'm not a heavy drinker. I can sometimes go for hours without touching a drop. I've sometimes thought of marrying, and then I've thought again. Never mind, dear. We're all made the same, though some more than others. And finally, we have no reliable guarantee that the afterlife will be anything less exasperating than this one, have we?" Thank you.
Hello, my name is Larry Bensky, and since I made my KALW debut about a week after Alan Farley passed, and that has been my first and possibly only appearance on KALW ever on election night, you may be wondering, why am I here speaking about Alan Farley? And the reason is that I was Alan Farley's boss once. In 1970, when I was not at all qualified for the job, I was hired as production director of KPFA in Berkeley, having been tossed out unceremoniously for exercising free speech from a free speech, free-form commercial station known as KSAN. See, there's some people out there who probably remember KSAN. When I got to KPFA as production director, which was the only job open with a salary, and I was was completely unqualified to do that job. And one of the people who worked for me was Alan Farley. So I became his boss. He had been there only about a year and a half. And what I didn't know about him and didn't learn until much, much later was one of the most extraordinary things about the man, that he had been chair of the math department at Morehouse College, one of the historical black colleges in Atlanta. I only know of one other person, Howard Zinn, who had that trajectory of being a non-African American full professor at one of the historical black colleges in one of the greatest times of civil rights ferment. So you would think that at a place like KPFA, he would have been out front and vocal and part of the continuing swirl of political babble and opportunism that was going on there at the time and still goes on. And that wasn't true. What Alan was a dedicated technician who enabled other people to do what they did. One night in my job as production director, it was my job to listen to the programming and make sure the logs where everything had to be written down precisely were maintained. And the station was supposed to go off the air at midnight or 1 a.m. So I always was awake at that time to make sure that whoever was there was A, going off the air, and B, was somebody qualified to turn it off, because it wasn't just throwing a switch. You had to take meter readings, you had to throw the switches in sequence, or the next day it wouldn't work. Alan was often the person delegated to be there because he could be counted on. And one night at around midnight, when I was listening in to make sure everything was all well, I heard this voice on the air, chuckling and telling stories in various voices, African-American voices, grandmothers, young women, preachers, seven or eight different voices, perfectly intoned and stated. And this entire scene was taking place in a whorehouse somewhere in the Midwest. And I said to myself, what is this? This is not on a program schedule. I've never heard this person before. And so then at the end, the person said something like, well, that's it for tonight. And then Alan's voice came on saying, you've been listening to KPFA, Pacifica Radio in Berkeley. We now sign off, 94.1 FM. Be sure to tune in tomorrow at 7 a.m. What the hell is this? So I came in the station the next day, and as it happened, it was one of those times of extreme turmoil, which never stopped there and was still going on, where there was a meeting that started at 9 a.m. and went until everybody was either passed out on the floor or left in disgust. And people were yelling and screaming and politicking and calling each other names and making coalitions and doing whatever we did. And Alan was in the room, and I wanted desperately to ask him about this, but I got sucked up in all this nonsense. And I had responsibilities to work, so I couldn't talk to him. That night, I turned on the radio again at midnight, it was my job, to hear sign off. It was the same guy telling more whorehouse stories. And he brought in a preacher and a taxi cab driver and all kinds of other characters. And the next day when I went to the station, I didn't see Alan. But I saw that on the log he'd written down, you know, dialogue or something like that, and he signed off again. The third straight night that it went on, the day after that, I made sure to find him. I said, what the hell is this? And he said, that's a friend of mine. I said, a friend of yours? This isn't on the program schedule. He didn't say any obscenities, but he was certainly telling odd stories. Who is it? And he said, well, it's a guy I know named Richard Pryor. I said, I've never heard of him. Who is he? He said, he's a friend of mine. He's a comedian around town trying to make it. And I said, well, he's terrific. We should take those tapes and play them again in live time. Now, you have to understand, in those years, everything on KPFA that had to do with, quote, reality, unquote, had to be taped. There was no live radio permitted except for the news. So I assumed that he had taped this. And I said, we've got to get those tapes and play them at a better time now. And this guy's sensational. And he looked at me and he said, what tapes? I said, you know, this Richard Pryor guy's tapes. He said, those weren't tapes. So what do you mean? He said, he was doing that live. I said, well, you taped it, of course. We can use those. He said, no, I didn't. And I said, why not? And he said, well, you ought to know why not. And I had a duh moment. I was the production director. I knew there was no budget to buy tape. We were out of tape. We couldn't tape anything. And so this magical, memorable moment, Richard Pryor doing the only three nights he ever did after midnight on KPFA, facilitated by Alan Farley, are out there in the ether, never to be heard again. But Alan, wherever he is now, I'm sure is listening to him with his characteristically understated chuckle and appreciation. Thank you very much.
Anyone else have a story or appreciation to share?
My name is Michael Johnson, and for approximately 10 years I worked at KALW, coming on as an on-call announcer in 1991, on-call, and then went on to kind of do, I think, about everything that you can do, something from doing fundraising, business managing, assisting Dave Evans, the chief engineer, on to general manager, a little bit of everything. And also part of that in the early years was hosting Open Air along with Alan. It's a program we shared together. And it didn't begin in the smoothest way because I was kind of, as I did, several people may recall, I like to challenge people a little bit. And so I was challenging Alan on some of the programs that he was doing on Open Air. And Alan first took kind of umbrage to this. He was not happy about me kind of challenging what kind of things that he was doing. Because, you know, as somebody was saying before, he was a little intimidating. It would make you nervous. But I tried to work with that. And I think we learned over time, and this Alan learned, I think, about me, that I was listening to his programming, listening to it, feeding back to him, telling him that was a great interview. This is, you know, something that was really, you know, I really liked what you did with that guest. And so we learned a deep respect for each other and worked together and actually ended up doing some interviews together. My best memory of Alan, one of them, there are too many to recall here, is interviewing Claire Bloom, the great British actress Claire Bloom, who was in town for a program called Shakespeare's Winter. And it was at the Cowell Theater. And we had interviewed her, or I was scheduled to interview her. I got to her first. and Alan kind of went, please, can I sit in? I said, look, let's do this together. Because he was thrilled, and we had a great interview with Claire and Alan and I. And our best memory of that was kind of a cap to the whole evening. It was walking with Claire through the grand hallway that leads down to the Cowell Theater at Fort Mason, and she was holding both of our hands and squeezing them. And Alan and I, after we led her onto the stage and backstage, we were each kind of, you know, tittering to each other about how thrilled each of us was to have, you know, walked hand in hand with somebody who used to hang around with Alan Guinness. So it was a great moment. And I learned a lot from Alan. I'd like to think we'd learned from each other and really had a great time working together. I got to see him just a few days before he passed on. And it's a fact that I think Joe Burke, who's here, I don't want to steal his thunder, but it is a fact that the Giants didn't lose one game after Alan passed away. So you make the connection. I think there's one there. So.
Hi, my name is Ben Trefney. I work in the news department at KALW, and I've had the chance to work with Alan for about the last 8 years. He was in a different room. He was doing all kinds of interviews all the time. And I mean, I interacted with him plenty, but Alan was a guy at KALW who had more people show up for his interviews in Lincoln Town cars and limousines. He interviewed the fanciest people. I remember sitting there talking to people in the conference room, and he would, there'd be somebody who he'd be talking with over our shoulder back through the window, and you'd hear, oh, that's Frank DeFore. You know, or somebody who I'd hear on the air all the time, or somebody who's writing that I just love. That's Ken Nagano, that's Michael Tolson Thomas. He just knew everybody. It was amazing, Alan Farley, the connections that he had. And, you know, I only had the chance to know him for the last 8 years or so of his life, but I did have the chance to visit him at his home after he became ill, after he retired from KALW. And, I mean, I don't know if y'all had the chance to see him there, but it was a really great space, and it really said Alan Farley. It was a pretty small place. It didn't really have a whole lot of triggers, kind of like KALW, essentially. But what it had was a great stereo system right here behind him in an easy chair, and he had a lot of music, a lot of classical music that he had a remote control for, and he would listen to that all the time. He had an entire wall full of books, and as you know, he hosted book talk and he hosted open air, so you might expect these two things, but it was wallpapered with books and literature. And he had his remote control here and his TV there, so that whenever the Giants game came on, he could flip it on. And he had everything that he wanted right there. It actually reminded me a lot of my own grandfather when I knew him late in his life, because he was surrounded by everything that he loved. And of course, before he retired, he was at KALW, which was also a place that he loved so much. He was by far the oldest name in the KALW. He was a model for what a lot of us did there and for what a lot of us do there still. And even though he was making a mess hall a lot of the time, it's because he really wanted things to be done really, really well. And he wanted people to learn how to do things really, really well. We tried to do them really well. But so when I visited him at his home, you know, a few weeks before he passed away, I was curious because I've been involved in public radio for about 14 years now or something like that. And, you know, he's in his 70s and he spent a lifetime doing this. I said, Alan, how do you feel about having been in public broadcasting for so much of your life? And he said, it's the best thing I could have done with my life. And I miss him. And I'm so glad I could be part of it, too.
Function, and he was every bit as wonderful as I'd always heard on the radio. I'm sort of a professional listener, so I really know when people are wonderful. But he had something else. He was a magician. I would start listening to some not famous person that Alan would be interviewing for a local performance, and I'd be thinking, this guy's kind of dull. Oh my God, what's he got to say? It's so boring. Half an hour later, I was still in the car, couldn't get out to go to work, still listening. This person had been transformed into a rich, complex, interesting human being. And how did Alan do it? I mean, he wasn't fancy. He was just, I don't know, there was just something open about him that allowed people to be their more complicated and interesting selves. And I miss him terribly.
State Senator Mark Leno sent a message because he was a fan of Alan's, and I'm just going to read a little bit of that. He says, "Dear friends and fans of Alan's, it's my sincere regret that I cannot be with you today to remember and acclaim the extraordinary life of our remarkable friend. From Noel Coward to the Gershwin's contemporary symphonic music to the standard repertoire to his concern for those who are making their way through the HIV/AIDS epidemic, Alan always had his finger on the pulse of his audience. Not surprisingly, his popularity continued to grow. Rest peacefully, dear friend, Mark Miner.
Okay, I'd like for Matt to stay here because when I opened this thing tonight, I said to everyone, one of my last conversations with Alan was told to me that I could do what I want. And I think in some ways I have succeeded. And I know that Alan would be happy if he was here today. The only thing that he might be slightly perturbed with in my doing what I want, I have a surprise down here for everyone at KALW. I have donated, in Alan Foley's name, $10,000 to KALW.
love you
Yes. for a nice soul. And so we asked him, just keep an eye on your work, in case that's what came up, one day that would actually be. And at that point, he had come back and he's walked so refreshed and energized.
And at one point, I told him, Alan, you know, if you want to borrow my bike sometime and go around McLaren Park, you're more than welcome to. And he said, oh, David, I've never ridden a bicycle. Totally astounded me. One of the things that I have gratefully inherited as host of Open Air is the theme song to Open Air, which a couple of weeks ago, a publicist, I've forgotten the name of the publicist, forgive me if you're here, said, Pepino D'Agostino is doing a concert with David Tenenbaum and the Pacific Guitar Ensemble. Why don't you have him on Open Air? I said, okay, I'll do that. Booked him in. And then someone mentioned, you know, Pepino wrote the theme music to Open Air. Did you realize that? I said, no, I didn't. So here with a song for us tonight is Pepino D'Agostino.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'd like to say that Alan was a friend, and he was one of the first people that really helped me out when I first moved to the Bay Area 27 years ago by inviting me to the show different times, and then, you know, we became friends, and a few times we had burritos together, and so I miss him a lot, so... It's nice to be here. It's nice to see so many people that are remembering him in such a wonderful way. So I'm going to play for you a piece that I wrote in his memory. Thank you. Thank you.